I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 146 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. Our guest this week has been in his band for 45 years, and he's barely over 60. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Jeff McDonald, the great singer-songwriter-guitarist for Red Cross. The LA-based Red Cross is one of those bands that's constantly mentioned in that sort of why-aren't-they-more-famous vein. I mean, how could anyone not have cranked up Stay Away From Downtown? But talking about bands in terms of their commercial success or lack thereof diverts the focus from where it should be, on their music, which either holds up or it doesn't. Red Cross sounded great when they were teenagers singing about Exorcist star Linda Blair. They sounded great on their 1987 punk and glam Meet the Beatles breakthrough album, Neurotica. And they sound great now. Red Cross has recently released eighth album as a self-titled double record that resembles the Beatles' White Album design-wise, but is, of course, red. It's also, as the kids would say, an end-to-end banger, roping in songs written and sung by Jeff McDonald and his younger brother, bassist Stephen McDonald. They're still catchy as hell, from Jeff's opener, Candy Colored Catastrophe, through Stephen's jangly I'll Take Your Word For It, through the brothers' anthemic finale, Born Innocent, which sums up their career and lives together in rousing fashion. Jeff McDonald talks about how he and Stephen wrote Born Innocent, which shares its title with the first Red Cross album, as well as a new documentary about the band. This conversation is infused with such gleeful music fandom, including a discussion over whether it's okay to reuse another song's title. McDonald also offers his perspective on who, if anyone, were Red Cross's peers when they began in Los Angeles, whether Red Cross is a power pop band, whether he sensed Neurotica was a special album at the time, how he experienced the band's move to Atlantic Records for the slicker-sounding Third Eye, and why the band took a very long break after the awesome Phase Shifter and Show World in the 90s. When I launched Caro Pop almost 3 years ago, Jeff McDonald was on my guest wish list, and he was worth the wait and then some. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Jeff McDonald. When you think about like your high points with Red Cross, is it more on stage or recording?
Well, unfortunately, I think our best moments have been on stage, which is, I say unfortunate because you realize those moments are fleeting. Once they're gone, they're gone. They're in the memories of people who were there, but those real magic moments always happen on stage, you know, always. And, you know, as far as like, you know, fun. I mean, recording sessions are, you know, you don't ever get that instant kind of gratification. You do occasionally, but it's always in pieces.
Right.
If that makes any sense.
Sure, sure. Well, so like, what would be those moments you'd look back on and think, oh my God, this is like a peak moment, this point, this stage at this time?
There's tons. It always happens. Like, I really, you know, when we're still able to, like, you know, conjure that great kind of experience, even now in our advanced ages, that to me is a peak moment. But it's like, maybe, you know, like the very first time we ever sold out a show in Los Angeles, and the audience was dressed like us, knew all of our songs. It was just like a kind of Stars Born moment, you know, that was like in the 80s. But yeah, you know, because when we had kind of struggled after our punk rock period to kind of find ourselves, and, you know, we didn't really have any peers or, you know, there was no like scene or groups that were like us. So, you know, we just had to play with whatever the underground music was doing. So the fact that, you know, we kind of were able to kind of get to rise above all that stuff was just super, super gratifying.
Yeah, it's interesting because now you're getting a lot of recognition as like a power pop band. And you've always been like, you rock hard, but you're really super tuneful. But you didn't come at that from the same angle as like the Paisley Underground bands or something. Like no. you were sort of not part of that scene, even though when you look back on it, you're like, oh, they were doing this really hard, but really tuneful stuff.
Well, I think for me, I mean, I don't mean, you know, all the Paisley Underground people, they come from different mindset. But for me, you know, my first music was Beatles and Rolling Stones, you know, since I was a toddler, essentially. And so throughout the years, everything I had discovered and loved was, you know, kind of filtered through that, you know, that was the bar. But when the Ramones first came out, to me, it was like the Beatles all over again. You know, they had that heaviness, that huge sound that groups like Black Sabbath had that I loved in the 70s, but they were like the Beach Boys and the Beatles, and their tunes had no fat, and they were short, concise, and really impactful. And that really, I think, did it more than anything, was seeing the Ramones for the first time on television.
Right. And you really came at the pop thing from this sort of punk angle. And I mean, like, mm-hmm. like playing with Black Flag is different from playing, you know, Badfinger covers or something like that.
Right. Right. I mean, I don't really know what the guys in Black Flag, I know that like Keith had a very, very wide musical taste. You know, he's like the one person I know that actually seen ABBA live. So kudos to him. But the other people in the band, they were coming from just such a heavy, stripped down place. Whereas when we first started writing songs and learning and putting our band together, you know, we also learned the value of, oh, let's do cover song. Like we had a whole set of songs, but then we thought, oh, let's try to do like a punk version of I Want to Hold Your Hand,
right?
The Beatles, or show our roots by doing, you know, an obscure New York Dolls track from the second album. And we did all that stuff. So it was, you know, it was like, it all kind of made it all make sense to us as we were learning how to write and to kind of create music.
Yeah. And the stuff that you're talking about and that's influencing your music is not like the sort of really obscure stuff. I mean, again, your songs are really tuneful. You know, you got a lot of energy. Why do you think it is that Red Cross was always kind of on its own as opposed to being like, you know, the leader of this big scene of bands that were like you?
Well, I think musically our roots were way more, we were way more rooted in like rock and roll than a lot of our, like, you know, say our punk era peers. And, you know, that's not always fashionable. You gotta sometimes just keep going until an audience finds you, you know. It was never our intention to ever be leaders in anything anyway. So that's no great disappointment.
Right. No, and you guys had your own fashion sense and, you know, unique way you presented.
We were very snobby in the sense where we kind of knew that we had a leg up on a lot of our peers. And when we recorded our album of covers, you know, it's like one of the first album of tribute records.
Right.
We were very snobbish and presented it as an educational record, essentially. Our punk pals in Los Angeles, who didn't really know much about, you know, what came before.
Doing a Kiss cover on a punk record was probably not something a lot of other bands were doing at that point.
No, but, you know, our peers the people who are our age in the LA scene, and so they didn't know girl groups. They didn't know really the Stooges or anything like that. Hadn't really, you know, the older people knew, but, and Kiss at the time was like a disco group, a failed disco band at that point. So right. It was kind of fun because, you know, we were, you know, very inspired by Kiss because when their live album came out, it was another coming out of the 70s, the fat, you know, with really like progressive fat music, having this kind of scaled down raw energy record was really refreshing. And Kiss, you know, they kind of took the Alice Cooper thing to the next level and turned it into a show, which was very appealing to us.
Right. Yeah. You skip ahead a couple decades and your video for Stay Away From Downtown is kind of your little Kiss visual tribute there. Doesn't sound like a Kiss song particularly, but it's also like this super, super catchy, you know, fast song.
Well, you know, that's the thing. You know, like, especially now with, you know, one good thing about the internet and one good thing about being able to serve up anything, we can do whatever we want, whatever we want. You know, it's like making a video like that now is just getting a friend with a camera and just kind of getting together, spending a couple of days doing it. Whereas we come from the 80s and 90s when videos were essential and they were like, they were insanely expensive. And there was only one portal to the public, which was like MTV. And like, right, they would just brush it off at a meeting. So it was just like not a functional time. So like doing something like Downtown, it was really fun because, I mean, I could imagine like in the old days, pitching something, oh, we wear this makeup, this Kiss style, you know, kabuki makeup, and throughout the whole video, you know, and that would have been a difficult pitch, you know, but we can really commit now that we're kind of more in charge of our own destiny, I think.
Right. Yeah. With these projections behind you and everything. And yeah. I love how you each like turn around one by one too. It's great. I would imagine like the videos for like Annie's Gone or Jimmy's Fantasy were like storyboarded very complicatedly to put those together.
Yeah. I mean, they were great. And, you know, the videos we made most of them with the filmmaker photographer, Rocky Shank, and we had great time. And I loved those videos, like Lady in the Front Row, Annie is Gone, and Jimmy's Fantasy. They're great videos. And, you know, but they didn't really get played, you know, some got played a little bit in Australia and Europe and a couple times in America, and, you know, which is a huge waste of money. But the cool thing about it is like, they hold up now. They're still fun to watch. They still look cool. So, you know, I guess it was money well spent, but who would have known, you know, that it would have any kind of life beyond like the first couple of months after it was made, you know? So at least now they're archived there where anyone can see them. So it's great.
What was the first song you wrote that you thought, man, this is a really good song?
I think it was maybe, you know, I think it's our very first batch of songs, our first EP, because we didn't know we could do. We didn't know we can put together a song from beginning, middle, and end. And I think that was like, wow, we can do this. You know, it's like I really had that feeling when we just our first songs. But after that, you know, I don't know. I just tend to like write them. Or collaborate, and if they still sound good after you've played them, you know, several times, then it's good. I don't know. I have never had that moment where maybe the first songs where I thought, oh, this is the best. You know, I mean, I don't know. It's weird. I don't know. Maybe I have, but I don't remember.
You weren't like, oh, I just wrote a swimming pool. Just wrote an addition on the house or whatever.
No, God, no. I've never thought in those terms. But I enjoy writing. I think for me, when it's like when we're going to plan on doing an album and I have to get in writing mode or making up songs, I just think that I'm so in the moment that I'm just kind of there until we have like, you know, 12 songs. It's just kind of like, where did they come from? I mean, occasionally they come from, you know, other sources. They're standalone writing sessions or from something that was written years ago. But a lot of times it's just kind of just in the mindset, do it, and then you're done. You know, so I don't know. It's weird. Mindset.
Do you write when you have a project too, as opposed to just like you're walking down the street and you're like, oh, here's a melody. I better get it down. Oh, I'm going to go write a song.
Yeah. Well, in the past I've written like, since we've been more free in the second half of our career, whereas we're not on a schedule of like a label. We're just like, kind of like not thinking about it until like, oh, we should probably think about making a record. And then I'll start playing with it, getting ideas down, and then we'll get solid, and then we will get a schedule, and then it will have to happen, you know. But yeah, it's weird. We're kind of left to our own devices. And considering we all are kind of a little bit ADHD, not undiagnosed, it can be time consuming and confusing. But, you know, yeah, I kind of just start when we're thinking about doing a record.
Right. You're not someone who just has to write every day or something.
No, no. And I'm not a person who like who has to write about certain things that happen in my life. That's the way I work through it. I'm not like that. I don't know. I just have to get myself in the mode, and then whatever comes out, out. And then, you know, I have a way of like, if it doesn't make me cringe, you know, then it's honest. But if I hit a single word or a phrase like in my stomach, then it has to be changed. And if the change doesn't happen, it's, you know, it's the song is gone. And this last record we recorded, we, you know, Stephen wrote a bunch of songs by himself. I had written songs by myself, but we actually made an effort to get together and write together, like in a room.
Yeah, I was wondering about that.
Yeah, we hadn't done that in years. I mean, for the most part, most of the records, I always wrote the majority of the song. Not because that was my job. It just turned out that way. I mean, Stephen always wrote, but a little bit less. He wasn't as, and I would not call myself prolific, but he was less prolific than even me. But yeah, so we started writing songs together, and so 10 of the songs on the 18 song album were us together, but they were written right before, you know, in the months right before we recorded them, and we didn't rehearse them like normally. We didn't get the arrangements together at all. We did that all in the studio. So we would say, okay, we'd do this song, and the demo would be extremely rough and have some of the lyrics on it. And, you know, and then we'd have to make an arrangement for about 4 or 5 run throughs, and then we'd record it. And so I never had the time to go through lyrics. And occasionally I would catch lines. I would catch a line like after it was recorded. And every time I hear it back, I'm like, no, no. So I would be able to record, I'd be able to get rid of it. But in the past, we used to be so prepared going in the studio, I would always catch all that stuff before we even went into the studio. So this time it was scary. It was scary because, you know, I wasn't able to do the final editing as much. But I think I caught most of it. Anything that made me personally cringe, I think I caught most of it.
At what point are you writing the lyrics in the process? Is it like hooks first, melody, then lyrics? Or do you start with a phrase, for instance, and are you and Stephen throwing them back and forth at each other when you're co-writing?
Well, there's no one way to do it, but it's like, for instance, on this album, I had the title Born Innocent because we were going to write a song for our documentary, Born Innocent, the Red Cross story. So that one had the title and we knew what we were going to do when we wrote it. We were going to make it kind of an origin story. But usually for me, most of the time, I will just noodle on guitar and just start singing on top of chord progressions. And then once I get going, then it's usually the melody chords first, and then I have to deal with the lyrics. Rarely do they ever come first, or they probably have before, but rarely.
So on the song Born Innocent, did you each write your own verse then?
Yeah, we kind of wrote them together. Like we kind of let, like each of us had our own separate verse, and you know, they're short, and we kind of just, you know, one person took the lead, and then we kind of molded it together. And then we wrote the bridge as together. And yeah, and there wasn't much to it. I mean, it's not like a really in-depth song. It's just, it's like a simple kind of, like to me, it was like Gilligan's Island theme song, you know, like the first version of the Gilligan's Island theme song, which is way more to the point and short. It's not like Tangled Up in Blue by Bob Dylan. You know, we realized like, you know, we're not going to throw 9 verses in the song. We're just going to see if we can make it interesting by just a quick little flash.
Yeah, I wasn't going to compare it to Tangled Up in Blue. Great song, though, that
but
is.
But you know what I mean.
I know. I totally know what you mean. But, you know, but at the same time, it's like, I mean, it's the closing song on the album. It's the name of your documentary, and it's the name of your first album. So it has this, and it has this, like, anthemic chorus where it's really, like, the culmination of everything Red Cross, and everyone's saying, born innocent. I mean, you could, you know, see people with their fists in the air on that, so... Did you come up with that first, or did that sort of come later?
No, I think that chorus kind of just came after I had that in my mind, just that phrasing, we are born innocent, all born. And so we just kind of threw it on. We tacked on the chorus. The chorus was the last thought. It was the last thing we did.
And then it's like the sort of wraps a bow around everything. So,
right. So that's the fun of writing songs. So writing songs can be very fun. And you know, I think the reason Red Cross still can make good records, we only make them when we want to, but I don't feel that I've written all my best songs yet, you know. And now that Steven's a little bit more active as a writer, it's even great now because he's really come into his own. He's really kind of discovering the joys of writing, where it was more of a task for him in the past, I think.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because Beyond the Door in this album, there's a lot more of sort of going back and forth between you two as singers and as songwriters as well. And I know he's been in other bands like Off and the Melvins. And I'm just sort of wondering what sort of musical growth you've seen from him over those years.
Well, Steven's always been kind of like one of the most musically inclined people that I know. Like even amongst the people who are musician friends, he just always had it. He's very musical. He's the person that can learn 100 Beck songs, in a weekend and be able to play them, you know, like when he toured with Beck and all that stuff. I can't do that kind of stuff. I'm not like a studio type musician. I'm just kind of more of a, just kind of instinctual performance type person. He can actually, play for others in professional settings where I'm not like that at all. So it's really good to have him, because sometimes it's good to have someone who has a little bit more theory based and understands how music works more than someone like me who's just completely works only on instinct.
Have you been sort of surprised by the stuff he's been writing?
Oh yeah. I mean, I was surprised what he's enthused, you know, like he would have like this last record, he had about 3 songs completed. I'm like, whoa, he's never really had that before. He's never presented like completed songs. Really. He would always know that he had a certain amount of spaces on an album that he would write the songs. But this one, he was doing it based on wanting to do it and having a need to do it and enjoying it. So that was inspirational for me as well, you know, because, it's just kind of, you have to, like, songwriting is weird. I mean, for me, I have to fall back in love with it every single time I start doing it again. Otherwise, I'm just not in that headspace. I'm not like the kind of person that is just, you know, very journalistic about as far as how they, you know, they have to be writing all the time.
Right.
So, you know, but Steven's, you know, he's more a very concise, more kind of autobiographical type writer, whereas I'm way more in the abstract. You know, I kind of follow that muse. And he likes to be more analytical than me. So I think it's interesting that we do it together. You know, it makes it not boring.
Right. And you two were co-writing on like Phase Shifter. I mean, is the process of when you collaborate now, is what you each bring to it different from what you brought to it when you were, you know, co-writing songs in those early albums?
Well, I think, when Phase Shifter was, you know, a prime example of a record that, you know, we had the songs, we rehearsed and worked out all the kinks. And if there was like, so if there were multiple writers, usually it would be like, there was some, you know, some, maybe a bridge that needed to be put on it. Someone came up with the bridge, or somebody came up missing lyrics or something. But otherwise, you know, these songs would be together and we'd always, but yeah, collaborating, you know, face to face is like is a totally different animal. I mean, it's good to have prompts. For me, I always have little noodles. I will like guitar parts, a melody, or a line. I keep my notes on my phone. Just like if I have no ideas, I'll look to my phone and find some ridiculous line that kind of just spawns something. And it's really, if I was by myself, it would be a much slower process. But, you know, working with someone else that you're very in tune to, it's really fun because you can just throw it back and forth. And, it, you know, and get instant, like, is that good? No. If that good, yes. You know, get approval or shot down.
Going way back to when you did Neurotica in what, 87? Did you have a sense when you finished that album that that was going to be a record that people were going to be still listening to pretty passionately 37 years later?
We knew it was special. I mean, it was different than a lot of the records that were out. But I mean, no, who would have guessed that, you know, 30, 40 years later, people still listen to anything. I mean, that's crazy. But then we knew it was going to look different. We knew it was going to, the songs were going to be different. We knew it was the special little weird record. Yeah, definitely. But I had no idea what, you know, what its life would be like.
I love how it sort of announces itself with, it's like the Sergeant Pepper reprise, but punk with a Convoy reference dropped in.
Yeah. So that's, you know, that's always, that's how we had found in those days, pre-internet, that's how we kind of would find our fan base. You know, we would throw things in songs like that. And then people would just, oh my God, they're referencing Convoy by C.W. McCall. Then they instantly had something in common with you. Just the idea that we would even do something like that. So, I mean, that's kind of like, those were what we throw out to find our people. I mean, we did it also with, you know, with our first two records, with Born Innocent and, sure. Teen Babes, you know, that's how we just slowly built a fan base, you know, just like giving secret code. There was these coded lines in all of our songs. I guess they call them Easter eggs now.
Right. Yeah. You were wrapping Easter eggs early on.
Yeah. And we always have done that. And we still do, you know, there's still riddles and everything. Some of this, you know, it's like proclamations, riddles, observations, you know, it's kind of this, we kind of do it the same way.
Linda, I'm sure I'm not the first person to ask you this, but did Linda Blair ever contact you guys?
No, but I could imagine she is so tired of signing copies of Born Innocent. She, you know, I mean, we always, anytime anyone meets her and has her sign Born Innocent or takes a picture, she's always very, very sweet, you know, but we've never met.
You've just seen the impact you've had on her life.
I think I guess in a way, yeah, we've kind of indirectly trolled her for 35, 40 years. But I mean, it wasn't our intention. I mean, we were true diehard fans, very inspired by, you know, her first batch of films, you know, as being of the same generation, you know, it was like, it was part of the 70s. The cool part was like anything Linda Blair had anything to do with.
Absolutely. A total side note, but like a friend of mine had a 4-track recorder and I would make up songs and we would record stuff. And my name for our little band, which never played a show or anything, was Chartreuse Microbus. So And it was before I'd heard Neurotica. I didn't discover till a little later. So, but I was just like, oh, all right. That was like my little Easter egg there. But
well, Chartreuse Microbus. I mean, that to me, that line just even bring, that sounds like a code for LSD. Because if you think of Chartreuse as the most insanely day-glow kind of version of color green, and microbus, even though it's like, it sounds like micro dot, you know, like LSD, micro dot acid. So, I mean, I don't know.
And they are, they are 11 long-haired friends of Jesus. So you would figure they're probably, you know, dropping a little microbus.
Yeah.
So what was it like when Atlantic then signed you and you did Third Eye? Did you have to change the way you made music pretty quickly? I mean, you had a different lineup in the studio.
Yeah, well, after Neurotica, between Neurotica and Third Eye, you know, in kid years, it seemed like years, but looking back, it was only a couple of years. There was like, Roy, the drummer Roy, left the band, and we had to find a drummer. And before Third Eye, we really built our live audience. We you know, from doing Neurotica tours and then doing tours before Third Eye. So the record Third Eye was just like, you know, it was a result of a couple of years of playing live. But as far as making the record in that environment, it was weird being on a major label, because it was obviously it was before groups like, you know, we had obviously had something in common with the grunge people and the people in Seattle, because, you know, we knew all those musicians from touring. So, you know, they were all like-minded people, whereas, you know, we didn't really have anything in common with people like Poison or, you know, Faster Pussycat, right, or other peers. So, like, you know, it's like, so when we make this record, it's like, well, you know, we're just going to have to be us, you know, because, you know, we're not going to, you know, we weren't going to get Desmond Child to write singles for us, and we weren't going to try to be, you know, Poison. So we had to be ourselves, but there was no one like us. So, you know, I think, and it was before like weird music took off. You know, I think it would have been, we would have been served much better had like Third Eye been a couple of years later. It would have made a lot more sense than it did when it came out. So it was just one of those records that was made on the cusp. Very strange album, still very strange.
Do you like the sound of it?
Yeah, well, it's very, very clean. You know, that, I mean, so I would prefer very, very clean than with a lot of 80s isms. I mean, like, you know, 80s had a lot of like really artificial, like aluminum sounding reverb cannon drums and just washed in effects and very synthetic effects. And it's not like that. So therefore, I think that's probably why people who like it still like it. If it was like a normal 80s record that was trying to sound like what was on the radio at the time, the record would be forgotten. You know, so I mean, it's a little timid in the sense that, you know, we kind of played everything to death just to get it so polished, but it's cleanly recorded, so I can't complain. But it is a weird record, weird time in our life, but weird record. We had to just keep working on things until they were just completely perfect. And whereas we never really did that before or after, you know, it's like, sometimes you work with technical people and they don't understand why you're playing behind or ahead of the beat. And that's because you grew up listening to the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and that's why music swings. But you're working with someone who's technical of the moment and they want everything on the beat. They don't understand that. So we didn't even understand that that was going to be a problem, that lack of communication. I guess in a weird sort of way, it's a musical generational gap.
Interesting.
You know,
well, and there you would, if you were starting out now, there would be more of that because it would all be put in the machine and they'd have to line up all the beats and all the notes and all, you know.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, since then, I mean, remember, like, you know, later on after people started to value that stuff, like natural swing, people like Hole, I remember one of the records Hole made, the Steve Lillywhite, was that the guy, the very famous expensive producer, was spending, you know, months and months putting drum beats and guitar beats a little ahead, a little behind the beat to artificially create that swing of, you know, and it's just so bizarre. So now, when you record everything eventually does end up digitally, and you do see the waveforms and you do see where they land, but you also know why, okay, you know why these beats are a little pushed or a little bit behind, because that's the natural flow. So if you naturally can do that, it's an asset, because you know, a lot of people who learn music in more recent years just learn everything right on. And the same thing with you know, auto-tune. People, you know, there's auto-tune is used, you know, to make like you know, Black Eyed Peas type computer music as well, but people also use it to, like, you know, clean up any kind of pitch issues that they have. That, because if you sing basically in pitch and you go out a little bit, you're not going to hear it, and so therefore you get those early takes that are exciting, not the takes that it took you 20 takes to get it perfectly on. But at the same time, you have to really watch it, because, you know, the music I listen to, a lot of times singer will sing slightly sharp for attention, or things, or harmonies will be a little out of tune, and it'll add a little chorusing effect, and that makes it really exciting. So you've got to be able to know the difference, you know, or else you just end up with this really, you know, boring, flat music.
No, I like hearing Paul's voice crack on If I Fell, even though I think it's either only the British or only the American one, but I'm like, oh, it's kind of cool.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And or they always did mistakes where they'd say the wrong word at the same time.
Right. I didn't, when we're talking about Neurotic, I didn't mention that you were, you know, after telling me that the Ramones were sort of the second coming of the Beatles for you, that you were produced then by Tommy Ramone. How much did producers in general kind of affect, you know, the album making for you guys?
Well, I mean, we weren't produced in the classic sense where we sat down and worked with the person, went through our songs, you know, lyrics and arrangements. We've never really done that. Like, that's like what Albie Gluten did with
Jellyfish.
Yeah. They worked like that. But they were more musical, you know, musically inclined, technically inclined than us. So we would just really work it out. And then we would depend on a producer to kind of make the final, you know, taste decision, you know, like, oh, that's great, that's too slow, speed that up, add this here, whatever. Small suggestions, but not like round up suggestions. And for Tommy, when we got Tommy early, originally we were going to make this concept album. Steven and I had this insane idea for a concept album, and we wanted Sonny Bono to produce it. And because I was a huge fan of like all the early Cher solo records, and there's Sonny and Cher records, but the early Cher, she made an album called All I Really Want to Do, which is like these kind of Phil Spector meets the Byrds, only doing like Ray Davies songs, Jackie DeShannon, all of the best writers of the day. And it's like obviously done really quickly, so it's very raw. It was one of my favorite albums. I still love it. And but Sonny Bono was the mayor of Palm Springs at the time. So we even were looking at, you know, another favorite, the Turtles were like amongst the most underrated favorite groups of all time. So we met with Flo and Eddie at one of our shows. And,
nice.
You know, but then I always think about the Ramones. The first four Ramones records are, you know, up there with Beatles to me. And the second Ramones album, Leave Home, always had it sounds more like a Phil Spector record than End of the Century does. You know, it was really compressed, and there was great echo on it, and it just had this 60s pop sound. And, you know, we had this idea, you know, kind of fantasy that Neurotica would sound like that. But, you know, Tommy was very smart in the factory. He said, you know, you don't want to have records that were, you don't want to sound like records that were recorded 10 years ago, you know. And and we kind of fought him on that a lot, because we did want we did want our record to sound like records that were recorded 10 years ago. And 85, what are we going to sound like, the Thompson Twins? I don't think so. So that was our generational back and forth with him. But he was just so great, because he just had the greatest stories, and it was just such a fun thing. But as far as like, yeah, ground up maestro, no, he was just, you know, he just kind of ran the ship behind the board.
Right. And then Phase Shifter, you guys produced yourselves.
Yeah, we co-produced with one, produced it. Yeah, because we did all of the arrangements, we made all of the decisions, but technically the engineer was John Agnello, who has done tons of great shit. He you know, he was the captain of the board. So in a weird sort of way, I would have to say, yeah, he co-produced it with us, but it was creatively us. And that was really fun, because after Third Eye, making, you know, a record with a really huge budget, and then thinking that you have to make, that you have to record a record that has to take at least 2 months to record it. You know, it's like we sort of bought into that. And then with Phase Shifter, you know, we had, you know, maybe half the budget that we had, maybe less than a third of the budget that we had for Third Eye. So we had to get in there and just kick ass and work and not waste any time. And so we were able to do it in like, you know, 20 days. Complete it in 20 days, which you know, which was, so it kept us insanely focused.
Was granted. There any outside sort of sense of, oh, grunge happened, so we want you to have those guitar sounds? I mean, I love the sound of Phase Shifter, but, you know, I just was curious if you were sort of getting any feedback like that.
No, I mean, we were using those sounds even before that. We just didn't really capture them correctly on record. We were never, but the idea that, like, after Phase Shifter, all these other bands, you know, kind of became the new mainstream. It was exciting for us because we knew where these bands were, the first generation of these bands that kind of came out of that post Nirvana thing. We knew where they were coming from musically and we related to them. So, you know, it was kind of fun to kind of be in sync for 5 minutes, you know, like to actually feel like we're part of, you know, we have a, but you know, it didn't last, of course, nothing.
Caropop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution's great beers include the classic Anti-Hero IPA and the premium lager Cold Time. Even past Labor Day, there's no better way to refresh yourself than with Cold Time. It's never pasteurized, and it's brewed low and slow in a method that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's available in 12 packs of 12-ounce cans. '93 was like sort of a big year in Chicago because you had like Siamese Dream, Smashing Pumpkins, the Liz Phair's album, and Urge Overkill, Saturation, and I had Eddie King Roser on from Urge on here. But I will say this for the record: my favorite album of that year was Phase Shifter. I love Phase Shifter, and I really thought, honestly, I thought that the hit on it, and this is how much I know, but I thought that like your the big anthem was Monolith. I thought that's the song that they're gonna play, and people are gonna like be holding their lighters in the air for it.
Yeah, Monolith, that song, I remember it being very kind of like, it was very inspired by the Teenage Fan Club. Because we toured with them on Bandwagon-esque, and their songs all had those kind of like medium tempo anthems. And the audiences would just all be in sync with it. You know, it's like kind of an interesting thing to watch. They'd all pulse up and down. And for me, and I think the only, I can say something about that song that drove me insane was, I think I wrote the lyrics like in the studio or something. And after it was done and out, I realized, oh my God, there's a T-Rex song called Monolith. And it just freaked me out. Cause I hate songs. I hate it when people just like take the same title and they're just lazy. You know, like they recycle the same title over and over. And I couldn't believe it that I had done with a record that was, I already knew, you know.
That's so funny. And of course, you now know, it plagued you. And I have a bunch of T-Rex records and I was not aware that there was a song called Monolith. And certainly at the time I wasn't, it didn't bother me at all.
But
it's
on Electric Warrior.
Oh, duh. I do have Electric Warrior. I just never paid attention to the song titles, I guess. Oh, well.
But that's just me being a nitpicker.
Copyright titles. It doesn't matter. You know.
Which is also funny because you can call a song Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Right. You can probably figure out a way to sue you for that. But yeah, no, it's true.
Yeah.
Like the Badfinger, No Dice. No Dice, they have a song called Love Me Do, and then straight up they have songs in a row, Money and Flying, and I'm like, why? Like you guys are on the Beatles label, why are you sort of drawing attention to this, you know?
Well, but, I try to find all the versions of Run, 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 you know, the Velvet Underground, The Who, The Supremes, I just keep finding them.
You guys should do a song called Lady. Because, yeah, Lady, you got like Little River Band and Styx. Commodores. Three times a Lady. Yeah. There's two of us. There's a bunch of two of uses aside from the Beatles.
Lady is really bizarre because we were on tour. We were listening to a lot of Kiss and I'm like singing. And we re-listened to. You know, we travel in this big sprinter van. So it's not like the old vans. They're bigger than that, but usually everyone has their is into their own phone, but occasionally we would listen to books on tape and record. So our sound man had never heard Kiss live. So we listened to Paul Stanley's album, which is incredibly relaxing and hilarious. And we played Kiss Alive. And I realized, Kiss used the word lady so much in their songs, like lady. I'm like, wow. It's like, I don't know anyone who's ever used lady in real life.
Right.
Well, that's hey, lady.
well, that's my honestly, that's my gripe with the John Lennon song "Woman." And by the way, Paul wrote a song called "Woman" that Peter and Gordon,
which is a great song
under the pseudonym Bernard Webb. If you really want to go into it, but then John writes "Woman," and I'm just like, "Woman, do I have to explain?" Like, when do you call someone a woman? Like, have you ever called your wife woman? Like, hey, woman, The mixed emotions at my thoughtlessness. I'm like, well, wait, why do you have mixed emotions at your thoughtlessness? Maybe you should have bad emotions at your thoughtlessness. And why are you calling her woman? But anyway, that's a sidetrack too.
Right. Well, no, but I get what you're saying. And you never know. You just follow your muse. And, obviously for him, it was woman. Maybe woman is an actual person.
Woman
and not a thing
it's a pretty song and hit number one and everything, but it's sort of like it when you sort of take a step back from it, you're like, I don't know. But
yeah, but I always think of She's a Woman when I remember that song was a hit. Oh, She's a Lady, sorry, by
Tom Jones.
I remember that was a big giant radio hit,
like 70s. Yeah.
Yeah, and I thought he said she's a wiener. And I thought, that was wow, they can use that. I thought it was a dirty word on the radio, but he says she's a winner.
Oh, you thought she's a winner was she's a wiener. That's funny.
Which that's makes good, more sense.
No, that's a good mishear. I love all the mishears, but I had a friend who thought Sly and the Family Stone were singing "It's a Family of Bears," which I thought was just the cutest. But
we have a song title that was a prompt for an entire song that was based on a misheard lyric. The song on our album called "The Witch's Stand,"
right,
was the Pledge of Allegiance when we were kids growing up in the 70s. The misheard version of it, I think, was it was like "One Nation," it was like "To the Republic, the Witch's Stand, One Nation, Underdog, Invisible," and we all and kids always misheard it. Kids of my generation, they from the 70s, always misheard the those words pretty much the same. I saw like it was like a candid camera, or kids say the darndest things, and it was like it was a 70s version when kids were saying "One Nation, Underdog" and all this, That's the same.
The Witch's Stand. That's funny.
But the Witch's Stand. Yeah, we were kind of living in a post-Trump era, so like, we figured, the Witch's Stand.
Okay. That's great. I didn't realize that's where it came from.
It was the prompt. Yeah.
Well, and then I have the Z Malibu Kids album, and you have the song "Fiona Apple," which you say is not about Fiona Apple, which I find confusing. But there's a line in there about researching the blues, and then your next album was "Researching the Blues" with the title track on it. So.
Yeah. That was she wrote a song about me while researching the blues. I just thought that sounded so funny. Like people, like it just sounds so pretentious to use that term. Whereas people who are into the blues, that's what you do anyway, because you're always going backwards and finding the source. But I just thought it was a funny way of putting it. And I don't know that line just, I don't remember if it was, that was Stephen or my line, but I just, when we were titling, when we tried to come up with the title for "Researching Blues," I just remembered that it just kind of jumped out of my head.
Right. So, well, I'm gonna go back to "Show World," which is the one after "Phase Shifter." Did those albums get out the way you wanted to? And did you have sort of ambitions of, we want this to be popular, or we want to have hits?
Well, yeah. I mean, when we it was a boutique label that was this way of based in England, that were, the parent label was Polygram, which was like the biggest label and the biggest European label. So we got to do a lot of those things. Like we were able to play on television, do things, just do all these normal kind of mainstream things, mostly in England and Europe. But by the time "Phase Shifter" came out, I mean, I'm not "Phase Shifter," Show World. Yeah, we had, you know, we had taken a couple of years off, so we were going to have to really kind of work to kind of get back caught up again. And but the problem at that time, there was a major shakeup in the music industry, and there was a consolidation where all of the major labels were purchased by three conglomerates, and it all happened like right before that label, the right that record came out, and everyone was, they frantically were putting people. Like we were on, we all of a sudden were on Island Records, but and so when we went to do publicity for Show World, you know, it was total chaos. And U2 had just released their album. The publicity were telling us like, oh, don't worry, we meet these guys and go on these tours and good radio stage. They go, oh, U2 Records, they just, you know, it's no big deal. They just kind of do their own thing on, you know, it's a well-oiled machine. They sell themselves. But then they all of a sudden had U2 Christ. So that was a kind of fun journey to kind of, you know, it means nothing now that the record's still out there for people to enjoy. But at the time of selling it, after creating it, the going into the sales section, it was this like total, complete, utter chaos. You know, and actual, you know, and people, the audience, they don't know what's going on behind. But for us, we had to, it was just like, oh, this is going to be a disaster sales wise, because everyone was just closing shop.
Did you do a lot of radio stuff and, you know, did changes in radio affect you? I mean, that's sort of one of the things is I was always sort of irritated by like how kind of constricted radio playlists would be. I'd be like, well, why aren't you playing this? This sounds like something you would play. And, you know, and I would have that gripe about, you know, not hearing, you know, whether it was not hearing Mess Around or not hearing, you right. know, whatever Blur single was, you know, coming out before, you know, song two broke them through, you know.
Right. Well, you needed to kind of get like someone on your side with like a powerful station like K-Rock. And Louis Largent, who ran K-Rock when at the time we did Third Eye and put Annie's Gone out, he just wasn't into us. He just didn't like us. And so he wouldn't add our records. And then he became the program director of MTV when we started doing,
oh, great.
You know, Jimmy's Fan. He didn't like us. And I knew people who worked there, and he's like, no, I don't get it. So like, you know, we were just screwed by like, you know, was like one major person that could have changed the trajectory, but because we weren't grooving and vibing with him, so he just put all of his eggs and, you know, and Red Hot Chili Peppers and Jane's Addiction and all that stuff. But yeah, we were just kind of because of him. But whatever, you know, it's like the thing about it is, it's like we, you know, we always just, our job was just to do records and do live performances that were very true to us and just kind of be artists. And we are still able to do that now. So it's, you know, it's really impressive. I'm very grateful at this advanced age that we can still do this.
Yeah, no. And again, you sounded great. Did it affect you much, you know, sort of emotionally at the time when you're just like sort of getting sucked into that record company vortex of dysfunction?
Well, I mean, by the time, you know, like with Show World, even though that was the initial push, we still toured the world and, you know, we still just did it for like a solid year. And by the time we were doing our last tour at the time in Japan, we were kind of just like, we were so fried. And our drummer, Brian Reitzel, he had these other things he wanted to do. Like he eventually became a music film composer. And he wanted just to start doing that. So we just said, okay, Brian, and we'll, and then we were just going to be on that hiatus. And we just stayed on hiatus for 9 years, you know, just like, I think we were fried. And it wasn't because of like any kind of big disappointment. I mean, I think we were successful in the sense that everywhere we played, we had an audience, but I think we were just so tired of being away from home and being in the kind of business aspect that, yeah, our hiatus lasted a long time.
Right. Well, and your guitarist, I don't want to mispronounce him, Eddie Kurdziel. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah. Eddie Kurdziel had passed and he was struggling. He, you know, he, all of us had sometimes had our own basic struggles, but at that time he was really struggling and he didn't really know what he wanted to do. And I was in contact with him a lot, but he hadn't found his way yet. And, you know, and he was on that dangerous road. It was he'd had an accidental overdose, which, you know, could have happened to any one of us. Unfortunately, it was, you know, he was such a talented, like an amazing, amazingly talented guitar player and really great for Red Cross, because he grew up with all the hard rock of the 70s and he grew up playing those in cover bands. He knew that stuff like the back of his hand, but he was like totally willing to go down any weird pathway with us. You know, we had much more underground roots than him. Right. So it was so much fun to collaborate with him. And when he passed away, it was a year after our hiatus started, it was just like, it was another reason, like, okay, this is not just about getting a new drummer and carrying on and getting back in the rat race. It was just kind of like everyone wanted to just do their own thing. You know, I was a new father, so I was really into that. I was into doing weird projects at home, recording by myself and with my family members. Steven was getting into, he went back to school, studying music, and, you know, he did, he started playing with other musicians and being available for session work. So, you know, when we got back together, it was just, we did it because we really, really wanted to.
Right.
And it was amazing that we were able to.
Thank you so much. No, it's really been a pleasure. And I've really loved your music all this time. So you were on my early list of people to talk to. So this is, I'm going to check this off.
Thank you. It was great meeting you.
That's all for episode 146 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Jeff McDonald for taking us through the fantastic music he's created over 45 years of Red Cross. Red Cross's self-titled double album is out now on In the Red Recordings on vinyl, CD, and streaming. Immerse yourself in it, and then hit the Wayback Machine to dig into those earlier albums. My sleepers are Phase Shifter and Researching the Blues, but Neurotica and Show World and the others are no slouches. Red Cross is touring the UK and other parts of Europe in October and November. Go to redcross.com for more information. Now You're One of Us, Jeff and Stephen McDonald's joint memoir written with Dan Epstein, comes out October 10th. The documentary Born Innocent, The Red Cross Story, has been playing at film festivals and should be coming your and our way soon. Go to redcrossfilm.com. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake. For a mere $24, you can become a Carol Pop friend and help keep this thing going. Please contribute at carolpop.com. Your support is much appreciated. I'm Mark Carroll. Please follow Carol Pop on Twitter, X, and Instagram at Carol Popcast. And you can follow me as well at Mark Carroll at MarkCarro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop conversation. Thanks.